Thursday, July 18th. Today it is Franklin D. Roosevelt against Wendell L. Willkie as opponents for the November election. The Democrats renominated the president early this morning at their Chicago convention, and this afternoon will pick a running mate. Meanwhile, in Europe, there are fresh German and British air raids, and in southeastern Europe, new Balkan disorders. Now here is the news direct from Europe. First Berlin, then London, and afterwards a report from our own national capital. Edwin Hartridge now reports from the German capital. Go ahead, Berlin.
This is Berlin. This evening at 6 o'clock, Berlin will give an official welcome to its troops. And the feature of the welcome will be a parade of these troops through the Brandenburg Tor and down the historic Unter den Linden. Even at this early hour, boys and girls and men and women are lining up or sitting on the curbstones, patiently waiting for the ceremonies to come. So for the second time in 2 weeks, Berlin is being covered with thousands of swastika flags, garlands, and other decorations. The first time was for the return of Herr Hitler after 8 weeks at the Western Front. And now the soldiers who have come from Berlin are to receive their welcome and the official thanks to this city for their work in 10 months of warfare. So there's no other news here today. For the past week, workmen have been busy erecting grandstands along the Unter den Linden. This caused a great deal of speculation as to what was to come. There were some who were wondering whether the final victory parade was soon to be held. And such speculation was not dampened by the refusal of officials at the Foreign Office and the Propaganda Ministry to explain what was going on. The soldiers from Berlin have fought in Poland and on the Western Front. They formed part of the 7th Army, which crossed the Rhine on June 15th in rubber boats in one of the drives that pierced the Maginot Line in the Colmar sector. Then some of them fought their way to the southeast corner of France, to the Col de Bonhomme in the Alps. This is the sort of show that Berliners have waited to see for almost 26 years. For 1914, the troops from Berlin left with flowers around their necks for the Western Front, but they never returned for the victory parade. So you can imagine how the ceremonies today will have a popular appeal to the residents of this capital of Germany. And this occasion is marked by a special proclamation of Dr. Goebbels in his capacity as Gauleiter of Berlin. His proclamation states, quote, "They are your sons, fathers, or brothers, tried in so many battles in Poland and France, who after months of gallant fighting for their homeland, will again see their captors for the first time. Millions of hearts are beating for them in this hour in warm gratitude. They shall be received by their native town as soldiers should be received. Soldiers who have tied to their banners the most brilliant victory in German history." And so this evening, these troops will goose step their way past the Brandenburg Tor and past the grandstands of the Premierplatz, where the American Embassy is located. And here's an item that will interest American sportsmen. Max Schmeling, the former heavyweight boxing champion of the world, is now in training to be a Fallschirmjäger, or a parachute trooper. Last night, I was shown a postal card that Max had sent to one of his friends from the training camp. It was brief, but apparently, the Black Uhlan, as he was known to the American sports writers, is enjoying his work. This consists mainly in learning to jump from a speeding airplane, land, and get into action with a machine gun or automatic rifle in as short a time as possible. Max Schmeling is 34 years old, a bit too old to be a parachutist. When he was called up to serve in the Army, he made a special application to join up with the parachute regiments. And so the personal intervention Marshal Hermann Göring, the commander of the German Air Force, his request was granted, I learned from his friend. Last winter, as you know, the former boxer wanted to go to America, but on this trip, he only got as far as Spain and then returned to Germany. At Berlin, on the English Channel, there was once a gigantic statue of Britannia on top of a huge stone pedestal. This monument was erected to commemorate the landing of the first British troops in France at this point in 1914. And in the latest German newsreel, there's a picture of this same monument being dynamited into small pieces of shattered stone. And thus, another symbol of the former alliance of France and Britain has been destroyed. This is Edwin Hartridge. I return you now to Columbia, New York.
This is New York, and here is a press association dispatch from Bucharest. The pro-Nazi government of Romania today is reported trying to stave off sabotage threats. Vigilance against enemy activity has been tightened after a series of mysterious fires and explosions which have swept the land. Balkan reports indicate that Romania suspects communist factions of perpetrating the disorders. Furthermore, extraordinary Russian naval activity is reported in the Black Sea region. Now the news from the British capital, reported by Eric Severide. Go ahead, London.
This is London. German aircraft continue their activity over the island during last night. Their raids, however, were not on a large scale. Damage is reported from only a few places where a small number of people were killed. It was really one of the quietest nights in several weeks. But this morning, six German planes dive-bombed a convoy in the Straits of Dover. Eyewitness reports say the German planes made off before they secured a hit. The well-known author Paul Morand will represent France as agent of the French government after the departure of the French embassy staff from London. Monsieur Morand headed a French mission in London since the start of the war. Now it is understood that for all practical purposes, the French writer will act as minister plenipotentiary for France, but he will retain no other title than that of agent. No one may buy a new car in Britain without a special permit. There is a shortage of new cars in England now, and the price of used cars has risen. So many have been requisitioned for the army after the loss of their transport in France. From Belfast in Northern Ireland, it's reported this morning that police have rounded up IRA members and suspects. About 50 men are in jail. While you are arguing about presidential nominees today, Britishers were talking around their breakfast tables about their own particular issues. There are several. The Burma Road, of course, British news broadcasting, the crops, and vitamin B. Vitamin B just made page one this morning. It will receive the attention of the House of Commons this afternoon. This is part of the wartime health program. Somewhere in the milling process, vitamin B dropped out of white bread. After 4 years' work, experts have succeeded in putting it back. The House will hear a final explanation today of why England yielded to Japan over the Burma Road. The road is now closed to arms and munitions. The British emphasize again that it will only stay closed if Japan really works towards establishing peace in the Far East. When this government informed Russia of the agreement, it said that Britain has in no way abdicated its original obligation to support China in her struggle to obtain an equitable peace. Britain's conception is a compromise peace. The Chinese conception is peace only when all Japanese have left China's soil. England is restocking her cupboards. The hay is in, and the oats, barley, and wheat are now on their way. The hay crop was the best in years. Farmers took it early, and they may get a second crop. 2 million extra acres were plowed this year as a wartime measure. But despite that, the total 1940 harvest will not yield any more than the harvest of last year. Crops on this new land were patchy, and pests took a heavy toll of wheat and vegetables. British news and feature broadcasts may soon go under a stricter form of censorship. The movement this way began last Sunday night at 9 o'clock. After Churchill's speech, there was a recorded eyewitness running commentary on an airplane battle off the Dover coast. As bombs dropped and the planes crashed and pilots floated to their death in the sea, the commentator talked enthusiastically on. It sounded like Ted Husing at a Rose Bowl. The respectable press of London took up the matter. Their editorials objected to a life and death struggle portrayed like a football game. They also objected to a talk by J.B. Priestley, which followed. He talked about army defenses at a seaside resort, which he frankly named. And indignant letters to the editor now complain that the famous author, who's England's most popular broadcaster, gave military secrets away. Maybe this is an example of the superior confidence of the British as compared with the French. In Paris, the animals in the zoo were taken out of the city last fall for safety from air raids. Well, the London Zoo is still a popular going concern. It's announced today that the zoo will be open on Sundays in August and September, a departure from traditional rules. Britain has learned its lesson about increasing hours of labor. The Minister of Labor confessed last night that the increase had gone too far. The appeals to workers to speed up production resulted in many young men and women working 70 to 80 hours a week. It was discovered that their health was injured and that production was actually decreasing. I return you to New York.
and such is the news from Europe. In the United States, the Democratic National Convention finally concluded its last night's nominating session at Chicago in the early hours of this morning, 3 o'clock by New York time. And in Washington, President Roosevelt was reported to have heard most of the reports by radio, sitting with an intimate group of friends in the White House. Now the latest news from our own national capital, reported by John Charles Daly. We take you now to Washington.
This is Washington. Nothing to say. The president has no statement to make until he receives the customary notification. It's the customary procedure to wait until this notification has been formally received, and it's one the president would like to follow. These few words were the disappointing reward 50 of the nation's White House correspondents received early this morning as a reward for keeping a more than five-hour vigil in the White House press room as the Democratic National Convention in Chicago nominated President Franklin D. Roosevelt for an unprecedented third term for the nation's highest official post. They were given to the tired and expectant group at 2:15 a.m. by Steve Early, the president's secretary, as he wearily left the president's living quarters. As the convention in Chicago jumped the gun last night and moved on a day ahead of schedule, the theme in Washington was waiting. Waiting for nominating speeches, waiting for balloting, and waiting for news from the president on when he would answer the expected draft summons to head the Democratic ticket in this 1940 campaign. Probably the persons upon whom the waiting was hardest of all were the newsmen of press and radio crowded into the White House press room, waiting for they knew not what. Early in the afternoon, the reports started trickling through from Chicago that this was sure to happen, and then that something entirely opposite in character was equally sure to come to pass. With no definite news coming from the White House, correspondents, usually as hard-boiled and unexcitable a lot of people as you could imagine, began to be touched by a bit of hysteria. They fell to making frantic telephone calls to one another. Is it true that the president is making a statement tonight if he's nominated? Have you heard that he's decided to make a radio address tonight? These and any number of other similar suppositions flew about the Washington air, none of them supported by as much as a single grain of solid information. Like the president in his quiet upstairs room, the correspondents clustered about the radio in the White House press quarters downstairs in the executive office building, awaiting in vain a statement from the president, a statement which they hoped would put a period to more than 2 years of forced speculation. The newsmen occupied themselves by commenting wryly on the flowing hyperbole contained in the various and varied nominating speeches coming over the radio. As the hours passed, the correspondents, losing the last vestiges of patience, began to stage with mock seriousness nominating speeches and demonstrations for candidates whose names were Joe Bloke, Oscar Schmaltz, and the famed American humorous character Elmer Zilch. As the expected nominating speeches neared their conclusion and the possibility of balloting loomed, correspondents who had been scouring the high places of Washington for information began to pour even more thickly into the White House press room, accompanied by photographers and newsreel men and a quantity of rumors. The haze of speculation after a while became a solid fog in which the mind lost even the reality of those few things of which it had been sure up to a short time before. A newsreel man, who I am quite sure has never been an etymologist, disgustedly turned to an intense and careful study of an awesome-sized dictionary in the room. Outside, in the White House grounds, all was quiet. Guards were at all the gates, and no one was allowed in who did not have a pass. The sidewalks surrounding the White House were bare with the exception of an occasional homegoer who cast a quizzical glance at the executive mansion and then passed by. It is generally accepted here in Washington that the president will make an address to the convention and the nation tonight and state whether or not he will accede to this draft movement and become the standard-bearer for the Democratic Party for the third time. The hour of 9 o'clock is prominently mentioned as the moment when the third-term enigma shall be laid to rest, its requiem, the tumult and shouting in Chicago, and the heartfelt thanks of the correspondents of Washington who can look forward then to nights undisturbed by the nightmare of speculation on the answer to the question that has baffled all their wiles and inside connections. We return you now to New York.
And so we conclude this morning's report of national and international developments, reported from Berlin by Edwin Hartridge, from London by Eric Seferide, and from Washington by John Charles Daly. Larry Elliott speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.